Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of mind do you have to have, like, not to stop the process of, like, what's going to go wrong, and I'm just going to blow up my amp?
Well, some people are afraid of looking bad, you know? Fear of looking bad, right? I look bad in front of 10,000 of my fans. So I will demean the amp
show.
To make the amp. See, but it is a strat, like Joe Perry said. It needed a good whack upside the frickin' Marshall. So we can't fault him.
Yeah. Boom!
Yeah, it's cool.
Boom! Right? We're talking about him, and then his shit blows up.
Look years later, dude. Yeah. Oh, my God.
I think that's awesome.
Whenever I need music gear, I always go to Sweetwater.com. If it's mics, headphones, or studio and recording gear, Sweetwater has you covered. Next time you need any music gear, support the podcast by using the link in the description and comment section below. Jeff Young, David Ellison, I am honored to meet you for the first time in my entire life.
Thank you.
So cool.
You too.
Welcome to Santa Ana.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Welcome to Santa Ana, and your shit almost got jacked, so welcome.
Yeah, typical welcome party, you know. Stuff gets broken into or stolen or hijacked or whatever, so. But we live to fight another day.
Well, luckily it was just, someone towed your gear.
Towed the truck. You know, it's funny, after all the years, have you ever had anything stolen? I've never had anything stolen.
Or towed.
Nor towed, yeah.
At least related to rock and roll.
Until we come to Santa Ana. This is where shit gets real. Over in Anaheim, they don't tow anything. Here in Santa Ana, look out.
So we've been put on notice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, what was that like? What, you just fucking just walk out? Like, where's the U-Haul?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Our tour manager's like, not to cause any panic, but the gear is gone. So it's, but they found it. Yeah, it had been moved to another location. So all is well. Just another day in rock and roll.
How do you know that something's towed?
I guess there was a sign, right?
It took a while. At first we thought it was stolen, and then the cop was really winding me up. He's like, don't you know where you are, son?
Oh. You're in the jungle, baby!
Well, it's very, it was a blessing that it wasn't a real crime.
Yeah, otherwise you'd be over here borrowing your Fender 7-string to go on stage tonight.
So. Sure.
Yeah. Is that an old one or is that a reissue?
No, that is custom made, about 4 years old now.
Okay. Well, I didn't even know Fender made a 7-string anything. I knew they made a
6-string
bass.
And we're learning
bass.
Today.
They don't.
Yeah. They did for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, nice.
Well, so, you know, Fender's all lacquer, so they put the lacquer, so naturally just kind of being fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been throwing around because Fenders are meant to be thrown around.
They are.
Right?
Yeah. As Richie Blackmore and Joe Perry have taught us, whack them up. I remember that was an interview in a Guitar Player magazine when I was a kid. Joe Perry said, he goes, yeah, Strat sometimes needs a good whack upside of the Marshall, and then it behaves better. And as a kid, when you have no money and you have like one guitar, you go, why would you do that? Now we have many guitars, and now we know why you would do that. Sometimes it behaves better. I had an amp the other night at the Whiskey. Plugged it in. I think we'd rehearsed with it twice. It was brand new, out of the box. I plugged it in, and it was like going all microphonic, and I'm like, what the hell is this? And the best thing to find out to see if it's going to make it work better is to hit it. You always hit it first, right? Punch
what?
It.
Is that a thing? You
punch it. Because then if it stops, then that means it's just something inside loose and rattling. I mean, immediately it's going to leave the deck because you're not going to go on stage with something that's not working.
No.
Yeah, like 100%. But it was just a good way to know whether it's going to go in the trash or if I'm going to send it back to the company.
Yeah, that's something you would do with like a TV.
Yeah.
So apparently you do that with amps too.
Well, maybe if you had an old tube TV and if you hit it, the tube would behave at least long enough to watch the show, right? So it's the same thing, you know? Yeah.
Speaking of Richard Blackmore, we're pretty near Ontario, and that's where Deep Purple played. I think part of one of the more recent shows with Ricky, and that's where he fucking he blew up. that's like the famous show where he like blew up his fucking full stack.
Really?
Yeah, it was here. Like, I'm like, what kind of mind do you have, like, not to stop the process of like what's gonna go wrong, and to stop that thought process, and I'm just gonna blow up my amp.
Well, some people are afraid of looking bad, you know? Fear of looking bad, right? I look bad in front of 10,000 of my fans. So I will demean the amp
show.
To make the amp. See, but it is a strat, like Joe Perry said. It needed a good whack upside the frickin' Marshall. So we can't fault him.
Yeah. Boom!
Yeah, it's cool.
Boom! Right? Boom.
We're talking about him, and then his shit blows up. Look
years later, dude. Yeah. Oh, my God.
I think that's awesome.
I've never seen that before.
You seen that, Jeff?
Okay. No. Look, all things in showbiz. Like,
you
got to
send me that. That's one step beyond. But I got a great Ritchie Blackmore story that I learned recently. You know, he's doing that kind of Ren Faire, Blackmore's Night thing with his wife, Candace. And so, because it's kind of Ren Faire, they end up playing a lot of castles and these kind of Renaissance parties. And they were playing a castle in somewhere in Europe. And he has a rule that he cannot be seen before that first chord that he hits, the spotlight when it hits him. And this was a daylight show, and there was the dressing room. The band would have to cross a bridge over a moat to get to the stage. And he's like, well, this will just never do. This is not going to work. So
I'm with him, by the way.
So his tour manager, Frank, had to rent some kind of kayak, canoe kind of gondola thing where they took Ritchie. And imagine the kind of Ren Faire garb he wears that looks – like he stepped out of the broke era. So like
right there.
Yeah, there. So imagine him all dressed to the nines in these shoes. He had the tour manager have a guy take him behind the stage in the moat, and he climbed up the rocks as not to be seen. Imagine seeing Ritchie Blackmore climbing up the rocks behind the stage in this awkward garb. Just
but I agree. You know, you don't see the bride before the wedding. That's the whole point of it, right? Show business, man. When you're on stage, and you hear me say this all the time, you're not in the music business. Record companies are in the music business. We are in the entertainment business. We're here to entertain, right?
I never heard that before in my life.
Yeah, we're in the entertainment business. So it's about when whoever the feature is downstage, right? Close to the audience, right? That's the person who's featured, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone else stand back. Right, we do it even on the stage of the Whiskey the other night, right? Or it's probably tonight too, right? Small little stage, but when Jeff's playing a solo, the bass player's not up front, fucking hamming out. You know what I mean? Get back, right?
That's what we do.
When the singer's singing, everybody else stand back, right? It's the featured guy, right? So
that's not climbing boots either.
See, just like that, right there. You know, you don't want to see that guy before the show starts.
You don't.
Right? You want that to be poof, bang. That's the moment, man.
You want, because during shows, you want like you're just creating
mystique
moments.
Yeah.
Because no one knows a whole show. You're just
that's
creating
a Paul Stanley line, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh shit.
I don't know if he invented it. I'm sure they probably got that from somebody. Maybe Paul did come up with it. But that is Paul's thing: is that you don't ever remember a full 90-minute show. You remember moments. You remember, you know, Paul flies, Gene spits blood,
fire.
Yeah, fire, the guitar has smoke coming out of it. You know, those are the takeaway moments that you will remember forever, you know. And so what you said is a true statement, you know. It's even tonight, you're not going to remember all, what do we play?
Two and a half hours. You're not going to remember the 2 million notes, but you will remember a few of them.
Yeah, you'll remember a thing, you know. And sometimes it's like a dude tripped or a guy, you know.
That's fucked up.
Jeff Young fell off the stage. Yeah.
The other night, my one moment where I introduced a song, and because the set list is tiny and it's like, you know, 10 feet away, I introduced a song, Jeff starts the other one. It was like, well, that was interesting. And then we go back and we play the other one. Like, that was our moment. That was like a moment of
that's
like...
That's a moment.
That's a unique moment that was unique to that show, right? So...
And that's what people will remember. But, oh, wait, remember when they almost kind of fucked up that song? But I think people kind of, appreciate that more.
They do. Look, they know, they know it's human. Plus, they're half drunk. They didn't probably remember it all.
Well, you remember, you know... Bach, or was it Mozart? One of those forefathers said, you know, it's not the mistakes. You know, people don't care if you make mistakes. That's passable. That's excusable. But playing without passion and not bringing the emotion, There's none excuse. No excuse.
And there's another good one. Huh. Once is a mistake, twice is jazz.
Miles Davis.
I believe I heard that. Yeah, Miles Davis. I kind of forgot where I heard that. Speaking of Kiss, were they the first band to like have pyro and have like a drum riser? And
I think they were. I mean, that was the thing is, you know, Zeppelin didn't have a drum riser. And it's funny, you know, I saw U2 the other night at the Sphere in Vegas. They didn't have a drum riser either. And it was cool. It was, you know, he had the shell around it because it's everything bleeds. There's basically the Edge had a pedal board. And I told Jeff, I said, he had a moment after one song where he had this delay, exactly like Jeff has. Because after the song ended and he turned it off, I went, oh my God, he's got Jeff's delay. Who knew the Edge had Jeff Young's delay? But he does. I heard it.
TC Electronics.
but that was, you know, Zeppelin, yeah, drums were on the floor. Then, you know,
they had Fog, but they didn't have the...
Yeah, and the fire and everything. In fact, I was thinking, would Kiss play the Sphere? And, like, you know, maybe they will one day. But, you know, it's not a pyro venue. I mean, pyro would be on video at the Sphere, right? You wouldn't light shit up over there at all.
Huh.
Unless the whole place burned down. But, yeah, I mean, look, pyro, look, putting the picks on the mic stand, that was a Kiss thing for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, there's so much that we learn. I mean, look, everything's been done. We just sort of borrow it and put our own stamp on it, you know.
Yeah, we just borrow and put our own thing to it.
Yeah, I mean, all the notes have been played, you know. So we just it's how you. It goes back to what Jeff just said. It's the passion. It's how you play the note that matters.
I like that. It's how you play it, and also I've heard it's what's also in between the notes.
Oh, we're looking at a fun fact. Pink Floyd were the innovators of pyrotechnics.
Oh shit!
Concerts. Yep.
I didn't know that.
A blast of smoke was set off at the back of the stage. Then bands such as The Who, Kiss, and Queen followed. Well, so I guess Pink Floyd once again. And you know what Pink Floyd's original name was? Megadeth.
Are you kidding me?
Kid you not. That was in a... Yeah, the D-E-A-T-H. And I don't know if they used it once, if they wrote it down on a tablet as a potential name, but there is a fun fact about that. Look, he'll probably bring it up. Pink Floyd's original name, Megadeths. The Megadeths.
The Megadeths.
Yeah, the Megadeths, right?
Now we got to put that out there more. I never knew.
Interesting.
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
Interesting.
Yeah. Apparently they never trademarked it.
I like this show because everything we talk about shows up on the screen to my left. Pictures, facts.
So, David, you grew up in a farm in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And you picked up bass at what, around 8?
No, like 11. I mean, piano lessons 11. Were 8, 9, then tenor sax in the elementary school band, and then bass probably like age 11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And with what you did is you actually wanted to be a bass player first.
I liked it.
It wasn't like the backwards.
And here's why. Like, I heard Sweet. I heard Ballroom Blitz. I heard that on the radio, and I went, those electric guitar. I didn't know what it was. I knew it was an electric guitar, and it sounded amazing, right? And distortion. I originally thought the distorted guitar was a bass. I'm like, what is that? I've never heard that before. That must be the bass that does that, right? And then a friend of mine had Bachman Turner Overdrive, Not Fragile, the gatefold. And so there's...
Amazing band.
Killer, great record. And they named the record Not Fragile because Yes had just come out with a record called Fragile, and BTO were heavy and not the kind of like a proggy band. They were pretty balls out, you know, a riff kind of band. And so you see the Strat, the Rickenbacker, the Gibson SG. So it's like, I was like, oh my God. And I saw the Rickenbacker. I thought, there it is. That's it. And I was like, that is the one that sold me on it. That picture right there sold me on the bass. Right
serious?
There. That's the
there
one.
There it is.
Yep, that's the one. And I actually have one of those basses at home now. It's a 4003. It's actually blue and white. That one's probably black and white. But and then, of course, I saw Geddy Lee on All the World's a Stage. He was playing one. But, you know, then I saw Gene Simmons, obviously the cover of Kiss Live with a Gibson Grabber.
And then you got to get a Gibson.
My eyes just kind of always went to the bass for some reason, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, thank God, because I guess we all need a bass player.
So you were just naturally just drawn to it already.
I was. And then I played a guitar for a minute because I woke up one morning and there's an
acoustic string.
There's a nylon string guitar on my chair. I'm like, who the hell brought that in here? You know, my mom was like, whoa, our friend said you should play this first. It'll help you play the bass better. I'm like, I don't want to play that. I want to play the bass. So I went straight to the bass.
Fuck yeah.
And then I learned how to play some guitar after, you know. And then I enjoyed playing guitar after. But, you know, like playing, you know, to me, and maybe Jeff would agree or disagree. To me, the guitar isn't just a broad instrument. Playing an acoustic guitar is one method, which I can do. Mm-hmm. Playing nylon string is a whole other. Playing rhythm guitar is a purpose. Playing lead guitar, because I'm a pretty good rhythm player and I'm kind of a good strumming acoustic guy. Mm-hmm. I'm not a nylon string guy. I'm not a lead guitar player. So to me, guitars, and if you were in Nashville making records and your name was listed in the Musicians Union, you would be listed under what your skill is, right? Mm-hmm. There would be four different acoustic guitar guys in town that would all get hired for various purposes of what they do, right? And even bass players in the 60s and 70s here in town at the local 47 Musicians Union in L.A., it wasn't just bass, it was Fender bass. It was a very specific, because there was the upright bass, and then the Fender bass was a very specific electric bass, obviously, that like Carole Kaye and people like this would record. So if you were making a record and you wanted upright bass was one guy, if you wanted the Fender bass was another guy. So these, you know, as you're hiring musicians, it's a very distinctive thing. And I think even today, you know, if you're in Kings of Thrash, you need Jeff Young, because like you need that guy to pull that off, right? You also need Chaz Leon, who's a great singer, rhythm guitar player, right? You need David Ellison to play the bass. So I mean every position in the on the bandstand is
and
a
Fred who
place.
Can play I mean when Poland came in and gave Fred the compliment that I've never seen anyone nail Gar, because Gar had a very idiosyncratic style, but yet Nick also grew up loving Nick Menza, and he can do that to the bone as well. So it's, and I agree with you 100%, because playing flamenco guitar, even classical guitar, which is two different nylon string styles, it's a totally different picking approach, where the classical players will play from their knuckle joint. And when I started getting into flamenco, it took me a long time to figure out, like Paco and these De La C and these flamenco, they play from this joint. That's how they get the real fast, because it's less movement. So you think if you're swinging your whole arm like a finger, it's going to be a lot harder than if you're just going like this. So the flamenco technique's more straight up. Like if you go watch Paco on YouTube, watch how he plays. Every time he does his fast runs, he adjusts his right hand to a very specific position. And if you don't got that, you ain't going to shred like that on a nylon string, which is the hardest of all guitars, harder than a steel string acoustic, electric, because there's no goose. There's no effects and barely any resonance.
You can't hide from anything. Right. And you've immersed yourself in studying like classical, jazz, blues, flamenco, gypsy. Correct. You know what? I want to ask you, Jeff. But what elements of that did you transfer over to metal?
Every solo that I was, Mary Jane Set the World Afire, was all me trying to imitate Paco. I was trying to imitate a flamenco gypsy player. And the thing that's a trip, and it doesn't show you how this is a way. Maybe the techniques are very diverse, but what you learn as you play music, and when I went into world music, it was really driven home that if you think of like that E to F, that Jaws, Donna, Donna, that half step progression that's in Set the World Afire, that's in Mary Jane, is also the hallmark of the Andalusian cadence in flamenco. So when you hear that half step in flamenco, dun, 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 it's the same exact thing. So I just went in Megadeth and played the same scales on electric guitar that you would play over flamenco. The only difference is it's through an electric amp with an electric guitar, and I'm playing it with a pick instead of fingers. But everything I was doing on those two songs, especially, so what you learn through music, and it's a great, I'm getting chills telling you, it's not how different we are as humans. It's how similar we are and how music connects us. And if you really look, it's what Bob Marley said, we are one. We are one.
Mm-hmm. Because you graduated in Ohio in 1980. Did you? And then you moved to Hollywood to go to MI. Did mm-hmm. you? Which you would go on to have a career in teaching. Was what was your thought and goal? Okay, am I going to go to Hollywood to go to MI to have a career in teaching guitar, or am I going to try to get a gig?
I had read an article in the back of Guitar Player magazine. On the very last page, it was a one-page article, and they had all the teachers, mm-hmm. one of them being Tommy Tedesco from the Wrecking Crew, who was like the most, he's the guy on the Partridge Family stuff, and just an amazing, amazing guitar player. All I needed to know is that Tommy Tedesco taught there and that Eddie Van Halen and Alan Holdsworth jammed together at MI, at Guitar Institute.
Oh, shit.
And mom, I got to go to this school. And my wow. parents.
I did the same thing.
My exactly. parents were scared shitless. I mean, they didn't know sending their young son across the country, you know, 3,000 plus miles away from Dayton, Ohio. Luckily enough, and it's so odd, that the night before I moved, Alan Holdsworth played the jazz club in Dayton, Ohio at Jilly's. And I took my parents to see him, and I got to meet him, and I even told him, Mr. Holdsworth, I'm moving, I'm going to Guitar Institute of Technology tomorrow because I know you and Eddie Van Halen played there and jammed there together. And
whoa.
I was like a 24 years old at the time, and I think he looked at me like, he didn't want that on his conscience. I think that this young kid was going out because of his influence to move out to Hollywood. He looked a little scared by that. But so I didn't really care about going out to become a rock star or whatever. I just knew from reading that article that it would put me at a school as opposed to going for a classical guitar degree where I would have had to study history and science and algebra and all this stuff that's totally unusable in the real world. And most of it that they teach in nice. Schools and in colleges is all bullshit to begin with. So I said, I'm not going to do that. Like what Randy wanted to do, he was going to leave Ozzy. Randy yeah. Rhodes was going to go and try to get a classical guitar degree. Mm-hmm. But then I found this school, Musicians Institute, Guitar Institute of Technology, that all seven periods are music. You're going to ear training. You're going to theory. You're going to country music class, jazz class, rock class. Every period of the day, you're immersed with a guitar in your hand. And I said, that's the place for me. And at the time, there was nothing else like it because this was 1984.
Yeah.
So I begged my parents, and they bought me a brand new Mustang hatchback. I walked out in the garage. Fuck. There was a bow on it, and off I
that's
went.
That's sick.
Yeah.
Wow. Can we get a picture of this car, Jay?
Is there a
it
picture
was blue.
Out there?
It was like sky blue.
See, Lake Jeff's a good salesman. Room. Now I want to go to MI. Because I was going to go to MI too. Same thing. Grew up Midwest. And that was the way to tell your parents, excuse me, how to get out to LA, right? Was to get out there. And I thought same thing. Same ad in the back of Guitar Player magazine. And I saw that and I went, this is a path forward. Like, this is the real deal. And of course, Van Halen was popping. You know, the West Coast is where it was at. For those of us in the Midwest, it wasn't.
Yeah, the week I arrived, Rat Out of the Cellar had just dropped. And they were doing all their rounds of interviews in L.A. as I was driving around town. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing Wanted Man and Round. And I was going, this is amazing. And yeah. I totally did the right thing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wouldn't necessarily recommend GIT because it's now a big, giant corporate thing. It's moved across the street. It's mm-hmm. a whole... It's not owned by the yeah. same people, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. that owned it and ran it. So it was a moment. Just like Megadeth and what we had. And I captured, I was lucky to be at that school at the right moment. Mm-hmm. You know, Jeff Buckley was there right before me. Halfway mm-hmm. into my year, Paul Gilbert arrived and became buddies
mm-hmm.
and hung out. So it was Frank Gambale was teaching there, Scott Henderson. It was mm-hmm. a great place to be. Jeff Berlin, if yep. Elson would have been there, he would have been hanging yep. with Mr. Berlin every day.
And also Steve Lynch, right, from Autograph, right? He was there. And that was a big thing because he was on the radio. When I got here in 83, Autograph was popping and all these bands. I mean, it was great because that was an era when lead guitar playing was exceptional. Of course, led by Eddie and then Randy, and but then, you know, George Lynch and Steve Lynch and these guys in the rock and metal world for sure.
Yeah.
But being a great lead guitar player was, I mean, that was a sought after thing to be. You know, now it's, I don't know, invent Facebook or be LeBron James or something, right? But back in that day, playing guitar was cool, and, you know, it was
just a ripping.
Thing. Yeah, yeah. Hmm. There you go. Autograph right there.
That's sick. You know what? I was listening to Van Halen Running with the Devil today, and no one talks about that fucking bass line, dude. It's am I sound easy? But no. the beat in that pocket, dude.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I showed you with Eddie Trunk thing the other night in Vegas, right? And so
Michael Anthony's there.
Mike, love the guy dearly. We become friends. In fact, I was introduced to him when I ran artist relations for Peavey. My boss who hired me to work at Peavey had worked at St. Louis Music, and then one of their big brands was Ampeg. And he had hired Ken Hensley, keyboard player from Uriah Heep, to do his artist relations. So when I called him after Megadeth disbanded in 2002, he said, he goes, I think I got something for you. I started doing some work with Peavey. I think I might have a position to bring you in as kind of the new Ken Hensley, right? So, which was perfect, and it worked great. So he introduced me to Michael Anthony, and it was when they were going to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I remember Michael was stressing out. You know, he was. I could see the fear in his eyes, like, because it was him and Sammy and the Van Halen brothers, right? It was definitely a divided camp, right? And I encouraged him. I said, "Dude, it's yours to have. Go, please. You have to go. Don't get bullied out of that by anybody. Go."
Yeah.
I said, believe me, I know. I've been in the same kind of band for many years, how these dynamics go. I said, go. And plus, you got Sammy as your wingman. You know, Sammy's fearless. He don't give a shit.
Sure.
He'll walk right in. He's got more money than everybody. He's fun. He's like the ultimate rock and roll frat boy, you know. And he's got all the booze and the plane.
Which is the most important part.
But those two guys are great together. And watching Michael the other night, you know, they did some deep cuts. They did like DOA, I don't know, Beautiful Girls, whatever, that he sang. And I mean, he is just, at his age, I've been doing a lot more singing now, so now I can appreciate the voice as an instrument and, you know, between talking and singing and everything. And just watching him just effortlessly go up and get on the mic and sing just like a bird, man. I mean, he was as much to me an inspiration as a singer as he was a bass player. And I told him years back when I worked at Peavey, he was at our booth, and I said, hey, man, I got a Megadeth story to tell you. And I told him about how I was playing, you know, as the story was told, I was playing Running with the Devil. Dave threw the flower pot down on my air conditioner, and that's what led to us knocking on the door and buying beer, and then we started Megadeth, right? And that's kind of a loose version of what it was. But so I at least got to tell Michael and said, hey, by the way, thanks for getting me the audition, you know? And he laughed. He goes, well, at least it was a simple bass part, you know? So, but you're right, 8 notes. Dun, dun,
it's not. I was like, but he would throw in right when you want it, the little slide.
Yeah.
And it's just, it sounds simple, but I know to land in that pocket directly with the kick.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some good stuff, and you probably heard it too, some stuff from Sunset Sound. They're in there now pulling up the master tapes. They're talking about what songs are recorded in room A, room B, or is it one and two, whatever the two rooms are. Talking about the different microphones that were used, and you can hear the audio about how they recorded live in, you know, as a band. And you can hear the bleed through the vocal mic where Roth was in the vocal booth. Even when he soloed that up, you can hear the bleed of the other instruments out in the room, the guitars and drums and the bass and everything. And so you can really hear, that's part of what made that whole thing blend so well, was the bleed of the mic. You know, now where everything's so clinically clean and everything, of course, recorded digitally, individually. A lot of that, you know, that ambiance is missing. But the way we used to make records, you know, in the big rooms and the big studios and mics, would, you know, you'd hear things bleeding over into the, you know. And in fact, the record me and Jeff made with Megadeth, So Far So Good, So What, our producer, Paul Lanny, was really on this big Mutt Lang kick because Def Leppard Hysteria had just come out. And it was the most cutting-edge record of that day. And so he started, like when Chuck played drums, there were no cymbals. in the kit. And that's a big part of getting the sound of a kit is cymbals are bleeding into the snare mic. And
yeah,
he made him overdub the cymbals.
Yes. Really? So he cut all the drums, then he went back and he overdubbed all the cymbals. That's why it has this weird washy sound to it. And we had a hard time with the mix. And that was when Jeff said he brought in Michael Wagner. He said, because we went to Bearsville, we did a mix. They're on some of the B-sides of the Megadeth re-releases.
Mustaine called me up from Bearsville crying. He's like, these mixes are horrible. And I didn't even, at the moment, because I wasn't really into Metallica, I never even thought when I mentioned Michael about the Master of Puppets thing. Michael had just been mixing my demos for my band, and we'd become great buddies, and I know he gets great sounds, and George Lynch and all the other people he's done. And I said to Mustaine, well, I can call Michael Wagner. And he said, do it!
Yeah.
And that the rest was history, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I realized that was the perfect guy because he had done Master of Puppets.
And now I listen to, you know, now on iTunes, thank God they brought back the original mixes from Michael Wagner, and then they've got the mixes Dave did. And look, you know, the mixes Dave did, while I don't care for those as a body of work, the bass sounds great on it. He did one thing on those mixes that I always had a problem with, which is as guitars got big and drums got this kind of big, you know, washed out room feel to it, the bass always disappeared. The bass was the first thing you never heard the punch, you never heard the attack. And in Dave's mixes, the bass sounds great. So, I mean, for that, I'm certainly happy. I think the bass sounds better, you know, than on any of the other ones. But as I now listen, even just refreshing for these gigs, I go to iTunes, I pull up, you know, the Michael Wagner mix, and you can really hear how he blended things together. You know, that's just the way it was recorded, how high we were at the time when we recorded it. Actually, Jeff wasn't high. He was not high at all, but the rest of us were. And how it was made, and, you know, the producer tricks to try to massage and get things to blend together. Then you hand it to the mix engineer. You know, he hears it. He hasn't heard this record before, so he's just getting used to it. And that's why you go out. You know, Andy Wallace is a popular mixer. These guys,
top.
You know, they mix things because they're not so close to it. You know, when you get really close to a record, I remember we did an interview, a podcast with Max Norman, and he talked about that. He said, you know, as a producer and an engineer in a record, you get familiar with every single note of that record, every lyric, every word, every note, every kick drum, because you hear it more than anybody else, over and over and over. You're hearing it. So even as Jeff comes in to play guitar, well, Max has already been hearing it because he cut the drums. He's already been hearing it as he cut the bass, and now he's hearing it when Jeff comes in to play a solo. So, I mean, you know, Max, for instance, will have heard that so many times. And Max is speaking especially to Mutt Lange, you know, which is why he was so hypercritical about the detail in all of his recordings and his mixes, you know. So, look, you learn a lot when you make records, you know, and making records is fun, but it's hard work. And, you know, I hear things, you know, on the radio that, you know, last night I was listening to that Ghost, Phantomine, the EP that came out after the last record. And I just listened to it. And it's mixed differently than the record. It's mixed heavier. You can hear it's got a bigger, ballsier sound. I think we recorded it at the same time, around the same time. But it's got a bigger, it's got a more metal mix to it, you know.
Yeah.
At least as I hear it, you know. So it's, you know, you can take the same, like, again, like the Megadeth records, the same, you know, record mixed by two different people has a very different outcome and a different emotional impact. You know, mixing is a real art.
When you hear the idea of, hey, we're gonna overdub the cymbals, like no one come in and be like, that's kind of. Or you just kind of trusted like the process.
Well, again, this was 1987, and it was
More so.
And, you know, again, the Def Leppard records coming out. You know, I think we probably all like Martin Birch, who was doing the Sabbath records, doing Maiden records. He did Rainbow. You know, we loved him as a heavy rock guy, but Mutt was unstoppable because, you know, he seemed to have the secret sauce. Whatever he did went to number one. And I think for Paul Lanny, as a producer, as an engineer, he was fascinated, you know, by that technology and how he could make those records sound as great as they did. And so, look, he tried, you know. It was we were always, you know, what was the saying? You know, I remember when our manager said that, you know, Megadeth, the world's state-of-the-art speed metal band. he came up with that. A manager did it, and it, that's how it hit him. It's like we weren't just a I don't know, bro. Let's jam, dude. You know, we weren't that band. Everything was very meticulous. It was very, you know, we were musically educated, you yes. know, and astute, and you know, so I don't know. For us, I think it was always about trying to go the extra mile to make great sounding records and mm-hmm. well produced products.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, you came in when there was. Oh, like, and that,
like
record,
2 weeks
two
left
weeks
before
left,
we
right?
had to play Christmas on Earth.
Yes.
Testament Overkill over in the UK.
Yeah.
So probably unlike any other guitarist in Megadeth history, I had no rehearsals with the band. I didn't hear any vocals, and I didn't even hear full songs. I hit the first tape I got, I mean, I was literally ready to leave L.A. I was like, this is a town full of posers.
Really?
And drug addicts and... I was trying Austin, Seattle, New York, UK. Where am I going to go? I was literally talking to my buddy on the way home from a rodeo that night saying, I'm getting out of L.A.
This place sucks. Mm.
I came home and my message machine was ringing and it was Dave Mustaine. Hey, I want to see you at the studio tomorrow. Come on down early. So I went down there, and everyone knows the story that I was Jay Reynolds' guitar teacher, and I was mm-hmm. he had hired me to help figure out Chris Poland's solos because I have perfect pitch. Mm-hmm. And I learned figuring out if I can figure out Spanish Fly and Eruption and all the Holesworth and Gary Moore stuff that I figured out mm-hmm. by slowing my dad's turntable down to 16 from 33 and a third, right? Because then it's a perfect octave lower, albeit it sounds like you're trudging through kick quicksand, but there was no YouTube and tablature to show us how to play any of this stuff. So that's how I taught myself, and Jay knew that because he had lived with me, and he said, I'll pay you $50 an hour, which back in 83, that ain't bad, to help me figure out Chris Poland's solos from Killing and Peace Sells, all the songs they were going to do live, plus you got to help me write solos for what was to become so far. And the first thing I remember, I was starting to write the hook and mouth thing, because I knew he liked Shanker, and I wanted mm-hmm. some kind of Teutonic, that German kind of sounding Flight of the Bumblebee kind of thing. But what I didn't think about, except maybe subconsciously, is I was engineering Jay out of a gig, because there ain't no way he was going to play that like this week, next week, in this lifetime. And I remember Chuck was the first one running through the room, and he'd walk through, raise his eyebrow and scurry out real quick, and then Gadget would come through. You came through, I think, a couple times where I was teaching, and they were all raising their eyebrows seeing me play the stuff and him struggling. And I think the kicker, though, what really cinched it for me is I went over to you and Dave's house in Silver Lake, and I sat on their couch, and I figured out Poland solo to Wake Up Dead in like 10 minutes, and I was playing it, and I think like, that's when I got
the
gig.
The guy. That's so funny. You slowed things down to 16, because as a bass player, you would never do that. Because it'd be like, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the guitar...
But as a guitarist, it's a great idea.
It sounds like a bass. By that time, it's so slow, and it's an octave lower, but at least you can hear the pitches.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
But the thing is, like, now you see I got that trainer, so I can make a little loop thing, and it's all electronic. But back then, you're picking up the thing, and it was a pain, because it's not always going back to right where you need it, and you're forgetting the part that you just figured. So it was a whole scene. But it was a process, because I first started out with, like, Aerosmith Dream On album, the first one, and Get Your Wings. And I'd come home from school, and I'd put that on, and I'd play down one side. I could play the full album, every lead, every solo, everything. Joe Walsh, Rocky Mountain Way, all this stuff. Ted Nugent, oh, Stranglehold, the entire Ted Nugent album I had. And then every guitar player, once you had that, then the next guitar player came out that was harder, you know, and then, okay. And then you just kept, and then Yngwie came out like a few months before I went to GIT, that Alcatraz album. That was my goal. By the time I got to GIT, I wanted to figure out every solo off that, which I didn't do, but by the time I was out of GIT, I had, and I'd met Yngwie and sat backstage with him. I showed you the pictures.
Right.
He's sitting there showing me how he held the pick one-on-one, just like this. And he was cool for everything everyone says about Yngwie. I only can go from my experience that he was the coolest cat ever. Very tender and showing me exactly what he did, because he could tell I really admired him, even though I was older than him. He's really young. I'm a couple years older than him, but he was super cool and funny. And So I was on my way. And it's teachers like that, between the teachers at MI that show you a little trick here. Here's how to hold the pick there. Here's how to sweep pick, you know, Frank Gambale. Or you go in Scott Henderson's room and he cuts your head. And that'll send you home to make sure that the next time you go in, you don't get your head cut. And so each teacher that you get, then you get a flamenco teacher that shows you, you know. And all that becomes part of your style. And so by the time I was playing with Megadeth, you know, I was trying to bring all that into them and hear Chris's thing, because we both loved Alan Holdsworth and Jeff Beck, which is why I thought I think I was able to play his style, because I already was into the similar stuff that he was into. And then you kind of try to bring all your own stuff and all your influences into amalgamation that doesn't sound like all your influences. And then you got the other three guys in the band that have all their influences.
Boom.
That could be similar or totally different, and that's how the sound of a band is born.
So it sounds like you learned from, like you didn't, because one of my questions to you was, what was your big takeaway from graduating there? But it sounds like you were just taking everything. You were just learning that and that and that, and then in this teacher, you put everything you knew into.
And I was lucky. Actually, the last half of the year, I kind of ditched out. I was getting A's on my tests, but I had a bass player, because when you go to MI, they had, at this time, they only had GIT for guitarists, BIT for bass, and PIT for drummers. Mm-hmm. And then you end up in a band in school. I had a BIT guy and I had a PIT guy. And for some reason, this drummer didn't work out. And me and the bass player went into Burbank to audition this drummer. He goes, well, my dad has a studio. We figured his dad's got a studio out in his backyard in the garage. We pull up. And it's freaking Evergreen Studios, the big place where they did all the soundtracks for Knott's Landing, Dynasty, all the TV shows, tons of movies, two studios, Barbra Streisand, Michael Jackson, Toto's equipment's in the hall. And we have, me and the bass player, we're walking in to do the audition, and I look at him and go, if this dude can play a note, he's got the gig.
Free and studio
luckily,
time.
Luckily, we walk in and he's got the Neil Peart kit. And so he's a really good drummer. And so now, not only had I had the GIT experience, now I'm going every day to the studio after hours for free, learning how to mix and produce and work this gear, which was invaluable. And it's everything that I use now when we make records, and why I'm such a 2-inch analog snob, you know, when we're doing our original stuff. It's going to be on 2-inch, dude. It ain't going to be Pro Tools. I'll promise you that.
There's something about 2-inch tape.
We're analog creatures. We are analog creatures, and we're not designed to input digital information or all the Wi-Fi and all these frequencies that are bouncing around, making everyone crazy and making us unhealthy and bringing down our consciousness, lowering down the consciousness of the.
Interesting.
Maybe that's why music isn't connecting with people the way it used to in the 70s, because it's not so much that the music isn't as great or there aren't just as great artists, but maybe the delivery mechanism is flawed. And you even heard Neil Young in Sound City, the movie, talk about when they came up with the code for digital, there's a flaw in the code.
Really?
And you can't, it's like just like an AI is never going to replace human emotion, right? Mm-hmm.
For sure.
I don't think digital. It's just not the way. And I've recorded like the same drums on the same song, digital. And because we did Bridges Burn at LAFX Analog, and then we did it in Arizona. Dude, anyone that says they can't hear the difference has got some cotton in their ears or head up their you know where or something, because it's a huge difference in the tone and how it hits your soul.
Yeah. When you cut a record on tape, how much. I hear stories from bands that have the record done. Like, how many rolls of tape is that?
You can fit. Well, that's the cool thing is you got to go in and be able to do it in one take. Like how Van Halen would do that. You got to be able to play it from beginning. There's no punching. Or let's just cut this chorus in here and you got to play the tune. You can maybe fit, depending on the length, like three tunes per tape.
Yeah.
And the tape today is like 475.
And it's not like you do like four or five versions. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, that. I remember when things moved over to the 1-inch to the one-inch digital tape, right? Yeah. Like we started to cut Countdown to Extinction and Euthanasia. That was kind of the precursor before Pro Tools, which had a good sound to it. But I mean, and it was still a tape format, right? So like Jeff was saying, you couldn't just cut a chorus out and cut and paste. I mean, but at least it had a... It was kind of the beginning of the digital, yeah. Then the DATs and all this kind of stuff. So it's, I mean, look, all this digital stuff, it has a place, you know, like loopers. You know, on stage, we even have some stuff for some intro tapes. It's perfect for that, you know. These things where things are stored. You know, we all use our iPhones and things for various things. But yeah, there is an emotional connection to these old these old mechanical.
There is
pieces of equipment, you know.
Something about, I'm always like thought about like what is my connection with like tubes and like speakers and like what.
So it's funny, you know. And it's funny, you know. Jeff and I went and saw Trans Siberian Orchestra the other night, right? And Al's rig, he's updated. It's Petrelli, right? He's our friend, obviously Megadeth alumni with us, and. You know, so, you know, seeing his rig, and he was telling me how he was kind of moving into some Kemper stuff, but some gear, some Marshall stuff that he has. And I remember there's one moment, probably 10 years ago, that I went to go see them, and he was holding a note as the whole band faded, and you could just hear the tube breathing. I mean, even in a big arena, you could just hear the tube just like, because he was just scorching that tube with his lead, this bend that he was doing, right? And it was so freaking awesome, man. It was so rock and roll, and it was just musical, right? Because the amplifier was partnership with the musician playing the note, right? And that's what was so cool about it. And I hear that right away when I walk in and I hear a band who's all digital on Kemper and stuff. I hear it immediately, and to me, it hurts my ears. It's not a friendly sound to me, you know. It's just because it's digital. And that's just me. I know for the convenience of the road, as a support act versus a headliner and stuff, it's helped make rock and roll affordable. A lot of bands couldn't afford to tour if they had to have amps and cabinets and stuff like this. I mean, we do because we're old school, right? We have amps and, you know, the other night I was on a gig in Vegas, and at Soundcheck, the SVT bass amp, which is all tube, nice, perfect, held up, had a nice big sound. But I think they left it on all day and all night. So by the time I went on last to play a couple of songs, the thing was like all mushy and farted out. And I remember when I was playing with Ronnie Montrose, same thing. I would sound check, and one night I remember I left the amp on. And by the time we got to the end of the set, I'm digging into the bass. I'm hitting it so hard, trying to get the notes to come out. And I realized the tubes were so hot. And it had been on so long that they got mushy, and they didn't stand up. And that's why generally I've tended to use, you know, solid transistor amps, because they're faster response, you know. And it's always there, you know. When you go for the note, it's there. It's always there. So what happened to me the other night with the SVT, a guitar player would love that, right? Be just like, oh my God, this is the spongy, cool, like groovy tone, right? So, again, different application, right? So, what sucked for me as a bass player at midnight would have been awesome for Jeff at midnight ripping a solo, you know? And so,
although Dimebag loved the solid state,
he did.
He was playing only solid state.
Yep, he had that. Yep, yep.
And getting a great tone with it too.
That was just his voice. It's crazy.
Yeah,
he's found it. Mm-hmm. So you come out with the record. So that touring cycle probably had to be from 87 to 89. So
August 88, we finished at Donington, which is now the Download Festival. It was Donington back then. In fact, Steve Harris's tech, Michael Kenny, he just since retired from Maiden about a year ago, but he was there at rehearsal the other day. And, you know, it's kind of reliving some stories because it's funny that all of us would be there at that gig at that time. And, you know, Iron Maiden, they were like a gang, you know, their crew was like a biker gang. You know,
this was like around the Seventh Son of the Seventh Son tour.
Yeah. So they were unstoppable, huge, you know, so.
And what was cool when we got to hook up with them, and I remember how, because Axl got Guns N' Roses kicked off the tour because he went to catering and he forgot his meal pass. Mm. And they wouldn't let him in. He's, don't you know who the fuck I think I am? I'm Axl motherfucking Rose. And Iron Maiden are gentlemen. And they're very soft-spoken gentlemen. And once they got wind of that, Guns was nixed off that tour, and we came in, and we had just come off the Dio Dream Evil tour where it was None More Black and dark. And so to play on that white stage that they had was the coolest thing ever, man.
So cool.
That looked like Antarctica. How cool.
I still go out because they would have, I think Michael was the one who would play the keyboards backstage on when they would play like Seventh Son of a Seventh Son on the road. And every time I heard that song, when Megadeth would do shows with them in recent years, I'd always run out. Because to me, Seventh Son, because we toured that album, we did seven shows on the Seventh Son of a Seventh Son tour, that to me was just such a moment of you know, for me and Jeff, it was our lives that we spent on that, on, you know, we did those dates in America with them, we did Donington with them. So that album to me, I as a fan of Iron Maiden, I love it. It was a very progressive album because that's when they started bringing the keyboards in, right? And so it's just that song is special to me. Whenever I'm at a Maiden show, I make sure to see that one. And I say see it because it's seeing the visual of it as much as it is hearing the song.
Yeah.
It's a very visual song for them.
Hmm. Hey, Jeff, it's kind of a trip. Like you were about to get the hell out of L.A. for obvious reasons. If you live here, you know what it is. And then all it takes is like a phone call. And now you're playing with Iron Maiden. That's a fucking trip.
Yeah.
This fucker.
First out with Dio, but that, I mean, the trip was, is so far didn't come out for about 4 or 5 months because labels back in that time, they needed that window. So we were still touring with the Peace Sells backdrop.
That's right, we were, yeah.
So I got a gold album when Peace Sells went gold because I helped push that gold with all those dates, you know, so.
Boom.
Yeah.
That's sick.
But literally out from being a guitar teacher, you know, to playing for four walls that don't clap to 30,000 people a night, that's into the frying pan, as they say.
It's special. How long was that that touring cycle?
This is like the year and a half.
Yeah, about. year-ish, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we did a lot though. Like I said, we did the Leeds thing. We did a warm up run up the
California,
West Coast.
California, Dio.
Then we did Dio
headlining shows with Warlock and Sanctuary.
Yep,
nice.
Yep. Then the Maiden and dates the Maiden. That we did in America, and then we went back over to Europe again.
We did Japan.
Another headlining run.
I remember Japan. Yeah. We were like the Beatles. In America they couldn't care. No programs, barely T-shirts. We go over there. We got programs this big. They've got our guitars already hawked and designed, selling models of our guitars, little dolls that look like us. Sick. The sound companies, they're like rocket scientists. The sound was so pristine, and they were just a whole nother level when we went to Japan. And it's amazing because the concerts start early, and there's definitely no mosh pit.
Yeah.
And the second you end the song, when Mustaine would start talking, you could hear a pin drop. I mean, they're just so attentive, and they don't want to miss anything, right? Mm-hmm. And we just go down to the bus early to get gifts. They're just amazing. I remember a 16-year-old girl said, I present you with this gift. And I open it, and it's a pencil drawing she had done by hand and framed that looked just like me. I'm like, I kept that for years, you know, moving. I've moved so much since lost it. But just amazing people all over the world that you meet playing music. And again, realize kind of what I said earlier, that we're not separated by language or color of skin. Mm-hmm. We're all one. And music is the best way to remind us of that.
Music brings us people together. It's like it's its own, it's cliche to say it, but it's its own language. I'm always, I think art, music, sports all kind of fall into that same category that just keeps people together and keeps us from bombing each other. I truly think like this fucking there's this because it just keeps us like this deep connection with every country.
But as of yet, you're not able to gamble and bet on music, so I wonder if that's going to happen. Right?
Not yet.
The MGM music app where you can bet. I don't know what you would bet. Are they going to suck? Are they going to be good?
Oh
is
wow!
Is the drummer going to make any mistakes? Bass player going to fall down? I don't know.
That might be your.
Are they going to play Black Friday tonight? I don't know.
You put it, if I were you, I'll put a patent on that. Because now you have like
share the royalties with me. I'm good. Well, we can split it. I'm a collaborator.
Because you got DraftKings is killing it.
Well, to me, that's what ruins sports. As soon as you start gambling on it, you've immediately ruined the integrity. That's Spirit of Radio, right? You know. glittering prizes and endless compromises, right?
You know, shatter the illusion of integrity. Oh, right? Yeah.
Right? Spirit Radio, right? By Rush. That was the whole point of that song. Was, you know, and again, as soon as you say Spirit of Radio, radio loves it. Oh, this is great. They wrote a song for radio, you know, but really they were kind of, Neil, I assume, wrote the lyrics for it, was probably mocking it, just going like, we have to play to this game. We have to pander to this. That was one of the first big records that really moved Rush onto the airwaves, at least in America. But it is. It's like that whole thing about having to, you know, play to those, you know, to those rules. I mean, I remember meet and greets. I mean, we always used to meet and greets. Like, you would play a show, a radio station would sponsor the show. So you'd say, mm-hmm. hey, we got 20, you know, radio station winners. You know, let's give them 10 minutes to sign some autographs. And you would always do that. It's just, you play the game, right? But then suddenly came up with the idea, you know, maybe it was Kiss. Hey, we can make money on this. Let's charge for this, right?
So is that where it came from?
And again, as these bands have set the stage for, I always say, I am a perpetual student of Kiss. I learned so much from them and always will, even though they've essentially quit touring. You know, you learn so much from how they ran their business, how they ran, how they thought, and how... And how they did things. But, you know, somewhere somebody in the, and it really is kind of in the late 90s, early 2000s, it switched, and now it's like, oh, you want to meet the band? Well, that'll be $250. You know, all of a sudden everything had a price on it. Maybe that's our version of gambling now. Fuck. I don't know. Right?
I didn't put that, like, when you think about like marketing your band, everything is like, everything, right? Yeah. I mean, toys, I mean, you name it. Like, you go to Kiss, right? Oh, yeah, Kiss has it. Yeah. Everything. So, the meet and greet, it's
them. They realize, you know, their fans want that. I do. Sure. I'm a fan. I'm a Kiss fan, right? I'll pay for it. I mean, I get Kiss Cola, and I don't have the coffin yet, but there's still time. I could write that in the will. Put that in the will. No. And make sure you bury me in a Kiss coffin.
David, that is not going to happen for a long time.
They need to make little Kiss crematories if you want to be cremated. What do you do if you're a Kiss fan? You need a little Kiss crematory.
Bury me in
box.
The Kiss mausoleum over in Forest Lawn. You know,
and Kiss fans are fucking obsessive. Every Kiss fan I know just loves that band.
I love it.
They have it. I'm wrong. Sorry. You can put your Kiss ashes
urn. There you go.
In the urn.
That's one Kiss way to urn. Rock and roll all night.
Dude, a urn?
That's fucking awesome.
Okay.
We're learning. We're students of Kiss as we speak. This is how awesome they are.
They truly took it to a different level. An urn. Wow. I thought I loved New Metal and Korn, but I guess
I gotta get my will updated now that I know that exists.
Exactly. Call the estate attorney. Get it written in the will.
Oh my goodness. Well, I really want to last touch on the record that you worked together. You really quickly mentioned that Jeff is not partying. You guys, how are you guys writing songs? Because I'm always curious, like, because all we have is like stories and like the legends. It's just are they partying and writing? Are they partying and then writing at the same time, or are they writing and then they're done and then they go out and party?
You know, look, I can only just speak to Megadeth, for instance, on that record, right? So, you know, up to that point, you know, look, Dave quarterbacked, you know, the majority of the stuff, right? There's stuff we put together in the room together. Peace Sells But Who's Buying was for sure a song, and if Chris was here, he would attest to, you know, the riffs were brought in. We put that together as a band. And that's why I think it has such an organic, natural, connected feeling, because it was done as a team, right? And it clicked together very easily. And some other songs later that would do that, Symphony of Destruction, same thing, Sweating Bullets even. Mm-hmm. These songs just kind of, you know, Dave would pick up a guitar, play a riff, we'd all jump in, and it just kind of wrote itself, you know. And so I think with Jeff and I on that record, I started writing a lot of that because it was just down to me and Dave, right? Because Gar and Chris were gone. It was me and Dave. We knew Chuck was going to be playing the drums. Chuck wasn't a writer, per se, in the group. But I at that point, had, you know, been in the group for two previous studio records. I saw how Dave wrote. I got the flavor of it. And I think, like in any organization, you have to go and step up and rise up to, this is where the bar is. This is what has, how it's written. This is the way it's written. You know, you don't sort of just walk in with a song, right? It's not like I just use the Beatles, where it's just sort of like the chord changes you're singing a melody over. Mm-hmm. And I love that type of songwriting. Megadeth is not that. You're writing riffs. You're sort of piecing riffs. The riffs together. Yep. It's a riff-based writing method. And so I started doing that. So on, you know, Liar, Hook and Mouth, you know, I co-wrote the music on that. You know, lyrically, Mary Jane, In My Darkest Hour, things that I participated in. So, you know, for me and Dave, that was actually a really good connection moment, you know, for us. I mean, we had our apartment over in Silver Lake that me, Dave, and Chris lived in, and now at this point it was just me and Dave. So we spent a lot of time together. Chuck was over there a lot. Eventually Jeff would start coming over because it was basically the band headquarter, you know. Hmm. So that's, you know, that's how that started. I mean, Set the World Afire was originally called No Survivors. It was the first song Dave wrote after Metallica. It was the first lyric that he had written, and it was he had the music pretty much done. When I met him, that song was done. Musically, that song was pretty much done. We used to play it in the earliest rehearsals that we had together. So that song just kind of sat off in its own little world until it was ready to go. And sometimes you do that. You'll write a bunch of songs, and you know, some of the stuff that's on Killing Is My Business was not even the first songs that were written. Some of the earliest stuff that was written ended up on P-Cells, you know. So this stuff kind of get, you know, a body of an album is like a body of work, right? It's like, does it make sense together, you know? So I mean, we build our set lists like that, you know. Do these songs make sense together? Are they grouped together in a way that is sort of tells a story, you know? So you know, so when Jeff came in, the songs were written, they were recorded, and now, as he said, we needed a guitar player. So he came in and filled in those spots. And as we've been doing Kings of Thrash, you know, I've now learned, you know, I mean, Jeff touched pretty much every song on that record, not just with leads, but with acoustic
with rhythms,
with bits. Yeah. And yeah, he did. So he's, you know, Jeff's footprint is
boom,
big time on that record.
Even cutting 2-inch tape, editing parts out while no one was there that we thought were too long. Me and who's the guy? Not Gadget, but
Matt Freeman.
Matt Freeman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Darkest Hour at the end, that climb, the chromatic climb, dun 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 dun, went twice as long, and I was like, man, that's way too long. No one, and also the beginning, da 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 da, was twice as long, and we cut that out. And once we cut it, it's too late. And we did that with no one there. I don't know if that was a good thing to do, but that's...
Yeah.
Did you know that we did that?
I didn't.
Mustaine never said shit.
You know, it's funny, though, now that you mention it, because now that you're mentioned, I remember that they weren't too long.
They were longer.
They were too long.
They were both the beginning.
Yeah.
The gong, da-da-da-da-da, was twice as... Da-da-da, was twice as long.
Yeah.
And at the climb, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, was twice as long. And Matt Friedman and I went and cut that out of the tape.
Literally.
When I was laying solos that night by myself.
People need to realize, boy, exactly what you're saying. You literally cut the tape.
Literally cut the tape.
Which would have destroyed the track if we couldn't get it back together right.
Yeah.
If Matt would have, and Matt wasn't like that seasoned to be editing tape like that, so that was a lucky, a lucky one.
Yeah, how do you do it? So you cut it and then...
They can pull the tape on the way the Studer machines, they pull the tape out and there's a little... A silver square flat cutting block, and you just lay the tape there, and you cut it, and pray for the best.
You make a mark as you wiggle it, right? You find the exact spot, and you wiggle it, and you can. And engineers who are experienced with this, they can tell if there's a cymbal hit or a kick drum hit or some dramatic event, and they move it, and they because there's a record head, there's a playback head, and a record head, right? So the playback head is where you're hearing. Obviously, the record head, once that engages, it destroys what's there before and prints the new material, right? So you're listening, and they always take a white ink, like a
little marker, chalk pen, and they mark where they're going to cut first.
Yep, they mark it. Yep.
They're looking for a silent spot where they're not going to cut anything, like a rest or a hot spot, or like you said, after a cymbal hit and there's silence, then that's the part, and then you cut it and pray.
Fuck.
Yep. And then there's some kind of tape, and what I never understood is once they put that tape... How does the sound still come through that little piece of tape that's underneath there?
Yeah, yeah. It's like a transparent piece of tape that, the audio can still be played. Because the audio is not obviously on this side of the tape. It's on the other side, right?
Hmm. So you're putting the tape on the backside. So I guess you got to get that really tight. That seam has to be just perfect. Then you put the tape on the back and So every album since tape was invented, they were doing that trick. Yeah. Fuck.
Cutting it, yeah.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
We
ballsy.
We are ballsy. You almost ruined the song.
That's why today, you know, with Pro Tools and digital audio recording, you know, it's basically cut and paste. It's like Microsoft Word, right? You cut a sentence out. Oh, I want part of it back. You just, you know, Control P and you put it back. You know,
sure.
You know, so that's I mean, that's the beauty of digital work. Is it makes writing much quicker. You can try different ideas. You could record four different bass parts and decide later, you know, once Jeff puts his guitar down, which bass part, oh, that bass part sounds better because of how he played the guitar. You know what I mean? So with digital, there's a lot of other creative options, you know, that I think have expanded it. Because with tape, once you commit, it's there, you know, so.
That is commitment.
Yep, there it is right there. They're doing it.
And Dave didn't say anything. It's probably one thing.
I think he was too high to notice or remember, and or maybe when he heard it, he liked it. I mean, because like you said, you felt too long.
Yeah, there was a lot, and that was a lot with Megadeth records. I think all the way up through Countdown to Extinction. Symphony of Destruction was 5.5 minutes long. It had a bass solo, two guitar solos. And finally, one day, Max just says, everybody get out of here. Leave me alone. I need the afternoon to myself. So he throws us all out. And we came back. It was a 3-minute hit song. You know, he just trimmed the fat. You know, so just because you wrote a bunch of stuff and laid it all out, that's part of it, but you know the arrangement of it and that editing, you know, is a huge part of that. Yeah, here we go. This is exactly there's a record head and
there's
a playback.
There's going to do it.
There's the two heads. The record.
There's the white pencil.
There it is. Let's watch him do it right here. There's a little.
He's doing this on quarter-inch tape. That's not
it's a razor. He just slit. Yep, that's it. He just took the razor.
And it's always at an angle.
Yeah.
Oh, the angle.
Yeah,
oh,
it's always an angle. And then now he takes this white tape that Jeff was talking about. See, there's. Look at this! This is great. This is it.
Done. I can place the pieces after the master tape. Cut a small piece of splicing tape with a razor blade. I place the splicing tape on the blade. This makes it easier to place it square on the tape.
And there it is.
All the air bubbles out of the splicing tape.
Wow! Look at that.
Boom.
There you go. And right there, they have a Jeff Young edit. No more double climb on that Mary Jane. He's editing Mary Jane as we speak.
Oh, fuck, dude. I didn't realize that you got to cut it at an angle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then cut it. That would.
Yeah. And, you know, the truth of it is that's how Mike Klink edited all of Rust in Peace. When we cut Rust in Peace, me and Nick would be out in the room together. Him cutting real tracks, I was just cutting scratch bass, but kind of playing with him for vibe and just kind of making sure we play the parts. And like Five Magics, and we called it the master of five tempos because it was literally five different tempos. We'd take three takes of each one. We'd pick the best one.
Huh.
And then Mike, it's the same thing. He threw us out of the studio for a week, so just go play tennis, whatever, come back in a week. And all the drum tracks were edited together, ready for me to play bass. So it took like a week to record it, a week to edit it, and then you play bass and start, you know, doing that. So,
man,
the making records, yeah, it's quite the art. And you know, I'm sure they used to do that with film at the same time when they're editing film back in the day.
Oh, and film too,
yeah. You know, so now everything is on. You know, obviously Avid Mix. Basically, there's a Pro Tools for film now.
Being in a band with a guy sounds fun.
It sounds like fun. Science.
Wait till 2024, bro.
Yeah,
yep.
Dude.
Yep.
It's about to pop off.
What was it like being in a band with Dave? Because we don't know. I did a tour but you weren't in the band. It was 2012.
There you go.
Yeah. And we got kicked off. It was cool.
There you go.
we got
that's
kicked off.
That's what it's like being in a band with him.
There you go.
Ellefson's not there, and you get thrown off the stage.
It was sick. We literally had to take our gear off the stage.
There you go.
And the last two shows, we were in Reno.
Hey, look. All
it was fun, though.
All
it was cool.
All the Dave is, listen, I speak to, there's obviously a wonderful side to his musicianship, his musicality, his ability to sell an idea. You know what I learned from him? Maybe there's four other guys in the room, their ideas were as good or better than Dave's, but Dave had a way to convince you that his was the best. And I think that was what was required. And Yngwie has that same thing. Yngwie has a way, obviously, aside from his incredible skill and a unique skill at the time that we hadn't heard that sound before. And probably with Dave, it was a new sound, right? Mm-hmm. Metallica and all this stuff. That it was new. It was like, wow, I hadn't heard this before. You know, that's what I felt when I met Dave. It's like, I have not heard this before. This is brand new. This is a great sound. But he had a conviction in how he would get you on board with his idea. Hmm. And he was such a good salesman with it that you believed it. You know, that, and that was a big part. You read it in his interviews, when he's on stage, there's a conviction. Ted Nugent was like this. You know, when Ted's in the room, you feel like he's in control, you know. And I always felt it sitting on the stage with Dave that when I would always say, it's like, I'm glad I'm standing behind him, you know, because he had control. If some guy heckled him, man, he would shut that fucking place down.
Really?
60,000 people just go, whoa. Like, they'd be and, you know, he just had that ability to do it. So, I mean, look, that's why he's a rock star, you know.
That's Well, thank you. I really appreciate you guys sharing those stories. It's
cool. You're welcome.
You know, because, I mean, our band started in 2002, so if we just look at those stories, man, what was it like, man? Like, 90, even 90s to us, or like 80s, and like, we only know California now. You know, it's cool and tape, and like, thank you for sharing those stories.
Yep.
Our pleasure, my man.
We're going to go make some music. Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you got to head out. Kings of Thrash is playing in Santa Ana literally a few miles down.
Yeah.
Cool.
Look at those handsome gentlemen right there.
Boom. Okay. as a fan, okay, so I went to your Instagram, right? Can you please put the fucking dates up there, dude? I'm like, because someone told me, okay, they're going to be in town. So I looked, okay, when are they going to be in town?
Oh, they're not up there?
We got to get back in our Instagram. Yeah. We're locked out.
Oh, you're locked out? Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
We figured
it'd
be like Rush. You announce it once and never say it again, and it's sold out. That's because that's kind of how it's been.
So really?
It's been nice, yeah.
That's sick.
Yeah. So, all right, but we'll do that for you. We'll do that next time.
Okay, you know, no one's tagged and there's no dates. I'm like, what the? Oh,
there it is.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Swords and tequila. Great. Swords
and tequila.
Yes. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And check out the coffee.
For sure.
How is it? It's sick?
Well, I think it's good. Yeah, it keeps you awake, especially when you go on late like we do and play 2.5 hours of punishing thrash metal. Yeah, it works. It works good.
Well, Jeff doesn't drink coffee, so what do you do?
Naps.
Dude, the power of naps? Oh, fuck. 10 minutes, dude.
I had one before the whiskey the other night, man. I was dying. I slept, I think, like 3-4 hours the night before. And at sound check, I was just going, oh, man. And I ducked out of VIP that day and went back, and I got a half hour, and I was like a new man, and we killed it at the whiskey. Check the videos online. It's pretty. If you can find Love to Death, I think you'll love it to death. It's pretty cool.
Sick. Any closing thoughts?
2024, bro. It's going to be our year.
Sick.
Dave and I got a lot of new music in the works.
Yep. Good stuff.
Working on new tunes. Cool. Sick.
Yeah.
Well, again, I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. I didn't want. That's it. Later.